$16 billion. By 2026, the global market for antibody drug conjugates is predicted to be $16 billion. In 2023, it was about $9 billion. And by 2032, it may be more than $38 billion. There is clearly a huge demand for targeted oncology therapies, treatments that destroy cancerous cells while preserving healthy tissue. Small and mid-sized biotech companies are driving a lot of innovation in this area, but they face some significant obstacles in getting promising therapies to those who need them. Welcome to our second episode of Partner for Progress, Strategies for Biotech Success, a podcast featuring seasoned experts who share tactics that help small and mid-sized companies thrive in today's market. I'm your host, Jennifer L.W. Fink, and today I'm joined by Sugato Day, Vice President of Regulatory Strategy and Head of Medical Technology at Allucent, and Alex McDonald, Allucent's VP of Model-Informed Drug Development. As we all know, humans have been searching for a cure for cancer for a long time. Chemotherapy was an absolute breakthrough when it was introduced in the mid-1900s, and it's still used today, but the search for better, more effective, less toxic treatments continues. Right now, there's a lot of excitement around ADCs and radionuclide conjugates. What exactly are ADCs, antibody drug conjugates, and radio conjugates?
I can take that one to start. Antibody drug conjugates and radionuclide drug conjugates are both conjugate technologies, but they have different structures and functions. ADCs use small molecule chemotherapeutic agents as payloads, and RDCs use radio-labeled isotopes as payloads. RDCs also have a slightly different composition than ADCs, requiring the addition of a chelator that chelates the toxin. ADCs and RDCs are similar in that they both use an antibody or small molecule-mediated targeting to precisely target the cytotoxic and the imaging factors. Do you want to get into it a little bit more, Alex, from your side?
Yeah, so the principle really behind both is to target specific molecules on tumor cells that actually then basically the toxin within the molecule, whether that's radioactivity or a drug, is actually focused particularly on the tumor cells and not systemically, like with systemic radiotherapy or with systemic chemotherapy. So that's the principle behind it, and that's why these things are often referred to as magic bullets.
And there's a lot of excitement around this, and there's already been some successes. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So, you know, first of all, the demand for these therapies has never been stronger, and innovation in the space is skyrocketing. I really think the horizon is ripe for truly game-changing therapies. And as just mentioned, we went from about $9 billion in 23 to anticipated over $38 billion over the next 10 years. Investment is also incredibly strong. As a few pertinent examples, Pfizer acquired Seagen for $43 billion. AbbVie invested over $10 billion in Immunogen. And Merck committed $4 billion upfront with a potential total of $22 billion for a stake in the three Daiichi Sankyo ADCs. So innovation in this space is as strong as it's ever been. And, you know, by the projections that we're anticipating, the interest is exponentially growing. And we know that investment, particularly in the biotech sector, is very, very strong in this area. So this is an area that is innovating very quickly from a FDA regulatory perspective. There is some new information that we'll get into a little bit later. And the pace of innovation on the regulatory and clinical strategy side of development needs to keep pace with the innovation of these technologies.
Alex, this is a relatively new field. Talk a little bit about, you know, when ADCs kind of started taking off, where we're at now, what that pipeline looks like.
Of course. So the ADC specifically kind of broadly mirror the development of biological therapies, particularly in oncology. The first ADC, as I recall, was Mylotarg, that was actually approved for AML, although had a bit of a checkered history. And there were several uses in lymphoma because there's very well-established sort of targets on the cells involved in lymphoma. So again, in the sort of late 2000s, they started to be more and more therapies associated with lymphoma. And then particularly within solid tumors, based on the work that the development of HER2-positive cancers, the use of treatments for that, we started to look at ADCs associated with HER2. And so there were several approvals in quick succession for treatments. And these were particularly for refractory patients who'd obviously failed these biological therapies. And that's now expanding and extending into new different types of solid tumors, different types of lymphomas with different types of targets. And that's growing exponentially from the successes that happened in the sort of 2010s.
Sugato, to date, there have only been approximately, I believe, 14 ADCs that are approved in the US, but there are literally hundreds in the pipeline.
Yeah, absolutely, right? So I think initially, you know, when these were first created, you know, there was a lot of proposals for monotherapies. And right now, with several exciting advancements on the horizon, researchers are definitely exploring innovative strategies to optimize ADC design, including the use of alternative cytotoxic drugs, novel linkers, improved antibody engineering techniques. And I think that where we are right now, as of this moment, is combination therapies are really becoming the preferred approach. So things that integrate antibody drug conjugates with immunotherapies or other targeted agents that could present synergistic effects. We have seen that some of the monotherapies that were approved using a conditional approval route based on phase two data have, you know, most of them have been able to stay on the market, but there is a couple, and we can talk about this a little bit down the line, that have needed to be withdrawn based on the confirmatory studies in the phase three arena not being as promising as a monotherapy. So I think the direction that some of these companies are choosing to go is to pair with an immunotherapy to demonstrate the optimal safety and effectiveness profile. And I think thinking about these elements early in development and really understanding the elements of what the combination should look like, dose selection, the right clinical trial design, these things can be hugely impactful for companies that are trying to enter this space. Certainly, there is a lot of competition, not just on a scientific technical level, but on the clinical trial side of things. There is a huge competition for patients. You know, there is a lot of considerations around trial designs that are going to reduce patient burden, you know, to the greatest extent possible. And these are all things that, you know, we would strongly encourage our clients to think about as they are developing these very important technologies.
Alex, what do you have to add to that? You know, obviously, clinical trials are a hugely important part of drug development, and this is a newer type of treatment with some unique challenges in terms of clinical trial design and patient recruitment. What mistakes might hinder progress and testing of these therapies, and what things should people be keeping in mind as they move forward into clinical trials?
If we're talking particularly about oncology, historically, the phase one and the dose setting has been basically chemotherapy based. So the idea is that the efficacy and toxicity are almost interchangeable. The highest tolerated dose is effectively the dose that you select to move forward. So that's a paradigm that's been in existence since the 50s. That's changing for a number of reasons, mainly around these new modalities that are coming out that are promising basically a separation between the efficacy and the toxicity. And I think an acknowledgement by regulators particularly that the old paradigm doesn't really provide you with an optimal dose. And so there's a huge amount of work that happens at the end around either changing the dose or managing the toxicity in patients. And so over the last couple of years, the expectation now is that you do a lot more dose optimization in the early phases of oncology drug development than you would historically. So that poses obviously challenges about how do you do that, what are the implications for the trial design, the numbers of patients selected, and picking the dose. So that's one aspect. The peculiar aspects for radionuclide conjugates are obviously that typically, because the nature of the radioactivity is that you don't actually have a product. The product is actually made by the bedside in effect. And so you have that extra complexity of dealing with the radiochemistry and the formation of the actual radioactive substance at the hospital, together with the specialist pharmaceutical side to produce the product that you can deliver. And typically, you only have a few hours to be able to deliver that to the patient. So that also has implications for the way you design the study.
It sounds like there could be some logistical hurdles there that definitely have to be considered so that you can construct a study that will be efficient and well run.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. We've definitely seen, you know, clinical trials get slowed down by this exact proposition, the lack of infrastructure and planning to, you know, look at these scenarios, right? And I just want to mention, you know, even before the clinical strategy and dose selection, development isn't easy in this space at all, right? So the manufacturing of ADCs is complicated, the antibody production, drug synthesis, and conjugation. The manufacturing costs as they stand now tend to be very, very high. And in many cases, particularly in the US, these are making these therapies somewhat less accessible to patients. You know, selecting antigens is another hurdle, as effective targeting relies on the antigen specificity to cancer cells. And this sensitivity is very crucial to ensure the precision of the therapy and minimize off-site target effects. The challenge is that not all cancers have well-defined target antigens, and the heterogeneity of antigen expression within tumors can further complicate target selection, right? So it's something, you know, from the very beginning of your development journey, it's something that has a lot of variables. A lot of different types of subject matter expertise are generally advisable to be included from the very beginning, and it needs to be a really synergistic conversation to make sure all the variables are appropriately captured. And I think Alex captured this. I think our focus on the discussion today is definitely on oncology, but even beyond oncology, the expansion of ADCs in particular into new therapeutic areas is very much underway. I think we're seeing quite a bit in the field of infectious disease already. So, you know, I think the applications of this type of technology are vast and are continuing to develop as we speak.
So there's so much potential, there's so much research, and there's a lot that has to go on as companies work to try and take advantage of all of this to get promising therapies to patients. And Sugato, you mentioned early on, you know, this is a challenge from the regulatory aspect as well. Recently, the FDA issued some new guidance, correct?
Yeah, they absolutely issued some new guidance, clinical pharmacology considerations for antibody drug conjugates in March 24. Alex is our ClinPharm expert, so I'm going to let him take the lead. But the guidance, from a very high level, it addresses the use of bioanalytical methods, dosing strategies, dose and exposure response analysis, and many, many different elements that have been, you know, kind of being done differently by different companies for a period of time. So I think the idea is that the guidance really harmonizes, you know, different modes of thinking and gives true guidance to, you know, as we said, the hundreds of developers that are currently in play. Alex?
I mean, ADCs are a complex modality. So you obviously have payload, which is essentially, at the moment at least, a sort of chemotherapeutic type drug. You have the linker, which keeps it together when it's circulating to prevent it from being released systemically. And then obviously you have the antibody that binds to the tumor. And so in an ideal world, everything is delivered to the tumor and does what it's supposed to do. But in reality, you still get the linkers and are 100% effective. Once the cells die, that the chemotherapeutic drug can be released from the cells. And so it's very important, particularly in the early phases of development, that you actually understand and you track that, even if it's only to the point to say, actually, we can't measure any circulating chemotherapeutic, which is a good thing. And then you can stop measuring it in your later trials. But these are things that you need to characterize early on. And clearly understanding the dose, the regimen is as important with this as with chemo and with any other pharmacological agent. The added challenge is radionucleotide conjugates. There's a number of different guidances around radiopharmaceuticals and radioactivity. And the added challenge with a radionucleotide is that its conjugate is that you've got a pharmacological component. That's the thing that binds to the cells. And then you have the radioactivity. And the idea around not only the pharmacological dose, but the radioactivity dose, or dosimetry as it's referred to, is quite a specialist thing as well. And so there are lots of regulations around dosimetry in terms of how much radioactivity an individual is going to be exposed to, whether that's systemically or whether that's within particular tissues. And so that's added complication, which at the moment there's not a complete guidance on those, but there are numbers of guidances that would help a sponsor to set up their early trials and understand what it will take to actually take a radioconjugate into the clinic.
How does Project Optimus fit into all of this?
So Project Optimus is an FDA initiative around dose selection in oncology, which we referred to slightly earlier. So this is very much the expectation now that you optimize the dose in a sort of scientific and rigorous manner before you go into large-scale clinical trials in oncology. As I said before, the old paradigm was you select a dose in a very small number of patients, and then effectively that's the dose selection done. So this is kind of the oncology catching up with other disease areas, really.
What about dose optimization? We mentioned earlier some of the challenges with patient recruitment, given competition for patients. There's been a movement towards including patients in trials who historically have not been included. For instance, elderly patients or patients that have kidney disease. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so there's a push from a diversity point of view to try and incorporate patients that maybe historically would have been excluded from early trials because of, let's say, an effort to either make the population more homogeneous or thoughts around protecting them in terms of safety. And what's happening now, particularly in early patient trials, is that, you know, those with mild liver disease or mild challenges with their kidneys can, in most cases, be included in those studies. And actually, it's a positive, not only for the patients, but actually for the sponsors as well, because they can gain useful information before potentially expanding in later trials into those that may have other sort of more serious comorbidities. But there's certainly a push both from the sponsor side, from the patient side, and from the regulator side to study these patients rather than either leave it to the end of development or to do these smaller scale sort of pharmacology studies where it's actually quite difficult to recruit those types of patients.
As quickly as this is all moving, the science is advancing, demand is great, there's ever-evolving regulations. Keeping up with all of that can be a challenge for small and mid-sized companies. How can they set themselves up for success?
Well, our approach at Allucent is to try to be on the cutting edge of regulatory and clinical strategy. I would say thoughtfully aggressive, but hopefully not reckless. And what we can really do is work with companies at all stages of development to provide a comprehensive review of development plans and data where available, and strategize on the best timing and content for various FDA interactions. Clinical trial approaches, as we've already discussed, are evolving as we speak. And, you know, many of them are making better use of adaptive designs and even real-world evidence. So there is, you know, different ideas that are being put forward in this space that can and should be explored during, you know, particularly the stages of development that are moving closer to mid and later tier clinical trials. The key from everyone's perspective, but definitely for biotech, is to plan ahead at every stage of development and execute very thoughtfully against it. You know, development plans cannot be static as they might be in other types of development scenarios. You know, there is Project Optimus, as we explored, is already at play. You know, sometimes you're going to get some input from, you know, dose selection analysis that you might not have anticipated, and you're going to need to go back and adjust accordingly. You know, there might be signals from a clinical trial that are, you know, not optimal and, you know, need to be adjusted along the way. So these things have to be looked at in a very adaptive way, and making sure that these are, you know, considered is a really good idea for developers.
What do you have to add, Alex?
Sugato covered the majority of that. I mean, I think from my side of the business, we start pretty much before we go into the clinic. And part of that is helping clients understand what it takes to get into the clinic, to help with the first trial design, and particularly in this setting where you're typically looking at refractory oncology or hematology patients, about getting that design as efficient as possible, but answering the questions that they need to go into larger scale efficacy trials. And particularly with these specific types of modalities where they're complex and there's newly emerging types of both regulation, but also the science as well, that we as a company can help them guide their way through that.
One of the things that is challenging for a lot of smaller companies is they don't have a wide breadth of expertise. And of course, we're talking about relatively new fields. You know, there's not a lot of people that have a ton of expertise in antibody drug conjugates, in radionuclide conjugates. These regulations are evolving almost as we speak. Can you share a little bit about, you know, your experience and how important it is to connect with people that do have deep experience and perhaps even, you know, some connections to move these projects forward?
I can start with this one. So as we said, the competition is fierce in this space, and finding early differentiators is very, very important. You know, there is accelerated pathways available through FDA once you get to a certain phase of development, and understanding the criteria to be included in that accelerated category is a really important thing that could be make or break for a given therapy, right? So, you know, we focus on the regulatory strategy, we focus on the clinical elements, but we also are focused on making sure that you're developing the right overall story for your product and how it can be differentiated from the competition, right? So I mentioned earlier, there is all kinds of disciplines at play here, whether it be CMC, non-clinical, clin-pharm, clinical, there might be a device delivery system. You know, these are all, you know, very interrelated and should not be siloed at any phase of development. These are things that need to be really integrated together, right? And particularly in the biotech space, you know, a lot of these companies are starting off relatively small, and there is a great benefit for them to partner with, you know, groups of subject matter experts and advisors that can help them navigate, you know, different parts of the journey. I think, I'm sure I'm speaking to the choir here, you know, trying to retrace your steps once you've, you know, gone down a path that might not be optimal is sometimes more time consuming than, you know, getting the input up front and putting it all into practice, right? So that's the thought process. You know, we love to partner. I want to, you know, really commend the FDA here also. FDA has expressed a very strong ability to collaborate with companies that are developing products in this space. They're very interested in putting groundbreaking therapies out, you know, to patients. There has even been a couple accelerated approvals that have taken place with phase two data conditionally. So there is a lot of opportunity for biotech here. And my advice is to partner with the right advisors early in the process. And then also when it's time to collaborate with FDA, you know, do it for sure. You know, I think we've definitely had, you know, some experiences where the client has waited, you know, maybe too far down the line to have that initial interaction with the clients. With the FDA, I mean, and that's been detrimental to the overall process. FDA is willing to have collaborations and provide meaningful guidance, you know, relatively early in the design development phase. And we strongly encourage companies to take them up on that.
That's a tricky timing thing for a lot of companies. Nobody wants to approach the FDA before they have everything lined up. They don't want to run into hurdles. At the same time, what I hear you saying is companies maybe missing out on opportunities if they don't understand how they can work together with experts to facilitate testing and development.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think you definitely don't want to go to FDA and discuss a back of the envelope idea, right? You know, this is something that, you know, there needs to be a balance between enough information and enough assumptions based on, you know, good science and early development and when you can get the best FDA input, right? So our advice, and it's obviously variable for, you know, the different conditions that we're working in, is that companies should think realistically about when they have well thought of and defined development plans across CMC, non-clinical, clin pharm, and what they're thinking in terms of clinical trial design, right? And as there are, you know, kind of branches in the road where you need to make decisions on a dose selection approach or whatever the case may be, we think that's really the optimal time to bring FDA into the discussion. Certainly, the challenge also is not to present FDA with options and let FDA choose, you know, whatever position that you're taking in your interaction with FDA. You should have that clearly supported in the briefing document and make sure that that is justified to the extent possible. But FDA, as I just said, and has a very strong, you know, culture of collaboration. They will provide intel, you know, based on the wealth of information that they have at their disposal and, you know, what some of the competitors might be doing. They obviously won't share specifics, but I think, you know, they will answer your questions thoughtfully based on the information that is available to them. And that is, you know, completely irreplaceable source of information that you can get nowhere else. So we strongly encourage that type of collaboration and working with, you know, advisory groups like ours. We can certainly help you understand the right timing for that approach and how to make the best of it.
Alex, what is your advice for small, mid-sized companies that are working on ADCs and radionuclide conjugates right now?
Well, in addition to what Sigarto said, I mean, I think these are targeted therapies by definition, and I think the future will be there will be more and more subsetting of the types of cancers based on the target. And so by definition, these are sort of precision dosing. And accompanying that is, how do I measure that? How do I select patients? How do we measure that during the trials? With radionuclide conjugates, you've got a possibility of imaging at the same time with many of the molecules, both to actually look whether you're targeting the tumor specifically and whether the targets exist. So, and then for ADCs, potentially, you know, measuring, does the patient have that specific target before treating them? Because clearly, if they don't have the target, they're not going to benefit from the ADC. So I think there's on top of the complexity of developing the drug itself, there's that piece around probably more and more going towards selected populations, which is in itself, you know, that's developing as a sort of a regulatory pathway in the association of developing diagnostics or using particular diagnostics associated with the treatment as well. So I think that's a challenge and an opportunity, I think, for sponsors that are developing these types of modalities.
So to add to what Alex just said, you know, we've kind of crunched the numbers a little bit, and we found that at least 9 of the approved ADCs were subject to accelerated conditional approvals. So, you know, this is a strong opportunity, and it's not a foolproof plan, but, you know, it's a really strong strategy, at least get something on the market and get some confirmatory evidence that these ADCs are working as expected, right? So a couple of these were subsequently withdrawn, Mylotarg and Blenrep. You know, one of them was withdrawn in 2010 due to safety versus clinical benefit concerns, and it was reapproved with the lower dose in combination with chemotherapy. And Blenrep was actually withdrawn just a couple years ago when the confirmatory trial did not meet the requisite post-approval safety endpoints. So the US FDA ended up withdrawing GSK's Blenrep license to manufacture in 2023, and that is currently still in progress. There, GSK, the sponsor for Blenrep, is executing a phase 3 study to use it in conjunction with bortezomib and dexamethasone. And early returns that were just published back in February of this year are very promising. So they might have a path forward to bring that back onto the market. So as I mentioned earlier, combination therapies certainly appear to be on the cutting edge of development and might be the place to start for a lot of developers to, you know, bring something onto the market with a favorable safety and effectiveness profile. And it's, you know, something that should be considered throughout. You know, the type of endpoints that you typically see in phase 2, including objective response rate and duration of response, are great early signals for potential effectiveness. But the phase 3 trials tend to be based on overall survival, progression-free survival, you know, those kinds of elements that are a little bit more difficult to achieve. So, you know, thinking about how to make the best use of phase 2 data and how that can impact, you know, definitely early stage accelerated approvals is a strong consideration.
It really illustrates the complexity of this landscape, that there are so many various factors to consider, things to think about in terms of design, as we've discussed, Alex, in terms of recruitment, dose optimization, and then how you pull that story together. Sugata, you mentioned that earlier, pulling the story together as you present to regulatory bodies.
That's absolutely right. At every step, it's really important to think about what differentiates your product. Is it the safety profile? Is it an enhanced effectiveness profile? Is it working better in combination versus some of the products that have already been approved? Thinking about all of these are important. You know, certainly the commercial aspect, you know, the price of manufacturing, the cost to the patient, you know, reimbursement, these are all considerations. You know, we spent a lot of time today on the science, but, you know, looking at the competitive landscape, where do patients need these therapies the most? What are areas where there is an unmet medical need? These are all areas that should be thought of very carefully in the early stage process. It's not always the best to, you know, necessarily go down a path that others have trod. You might think that you might be able to do it better, but ultimately the lift that you may have in demonstrating that your product is superior is potentially also higher. So in some cases, entering a market that is less saturated might be advisable. It all depends on, you know, the technology that's at play and, you know, how you're considering this overall. So my final thought here is that there is incredible promise in this field, and we have barely seen the tip of the iceberg. For developers, it's important to keep in mind that you have to plan carefully, be thoughtfully aggressive when the opportunity calls for it, and engage with thought leaders and regulators early as often. Some rules are definitely meant to be broken, and I strongly believe that this field will push oncology treatment into a new frontier, and at the same time encourage regulators to think creatively. So it's a great place to be in. We're very happy to work with the companies in this space, and we wish everyone that is in this field the best of luck in their development journeys.
Well, gentlemen, Sugata, Alex, thank you both for your time, for your expertise today. As we have discussed, antibody drug conjugates and radionuclide conjugates are revolutionizing the treatment of cancer and show promise in other disease states as well. In this episode, we explored the unique challenges small and mid-sized biotech companies may face as they develop ADCs and radionuclide conjugates. We also detailed strategies that companies can use to successfully navigate the regulatory landscape. In our next episode, we will discuss artificial intelligence, GCP compliance, and inspection readiness in clinical trials. Thanks to all of you who joined us, and I encourage you to join us for our next episode of Partner for Progress, Strategies for Biotech Success. Until then, goodbye.